And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today, September 11th, the 254th day of the year. Leap year is 255th day. 111 days remain until the year is over. Since 2001, this date's been mainly known for the terrorist attacks that occurred in New York City. When we lived in New York, I used to be in and out of the World Trade Center all the time. In fact, right after we got married, we celebrated our wedding at Wonders in the World, which was the restaurant on top of the World Trade Center. But this isn't the only terrorist event that took place. 1973, the Chilean coup d'etat overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende and began 17 years of dictatorship in Chile. Over 3,000 people died or vanished. Well, we're going to talk more about the terrorist attacks. In the year AD 9, the Battle of Teutoburg Forest ends. The Roman Empire suffered the greatest defeat of its history, and the Rhine was established as the border between the Empire and the so-called barbarians for the next 400 years. The Romans, surprisingly enough, got trounced. It was called the Varian Disaster. An alliance of Germanic tribes ambushed and destroyed, I mean completely decimated, three Roman legions and their auxiliaries. The alliance was led by Arminius, a Germanic officer of Varius's auxiliary. He had acquired Roman citizenship and gotten a Roman military education. And he used that knowledge to deceive the Roman commander and anticipated the Roman army's tactical responses. Yeah, despite several successful campaigns and raids by the Romans after that battle, never again did they attempt to conquer the Germanic territories east of the Rhine, except for Germania Superior. But it was interesting to note that it took some doing to defeat a Roman legion. And in this particular case, they beat three of them. And that was a strong force. All right, in 1185, Isaac II Angelos kills Stephen Agio Christophoritis and appeals to the people, resulting in a revolt that deposes Andronicus the First Comnenus and places Isaac on the throne of the Byzantine Empire. Now, the Byzantine Empire was actually what was originally the Eastern Roman Empire. 1226, the first recorded instance of the Catholic practice of perpetual Eucharistic adoration formally begins in Avignon, France. 1297, Battle of Stirling Bridge. The Scots, led by William Wallace and Andrew Moray, defeat the English, which was a rare occasion. 1390, Lithuanian Civil War. Teutonic Knights begin a 5-week siege of Vilnius. 1541, of the Knights Templar. 1541, Santiago, Chile is besieged by indigenous warriors led by Machi Malanco to free 8 indigenous chiefs held captive by the Spaniards. But the Spaniards decapitated them and rolled their heads onto the main square, horrifying the indigenous warriors, and it frankly ended the attack. 1565, Ottoman forces retreat from Malta, which ends the Great Siege of Malta. 1609. Henry Hudson discovers Manhattan Island and the indigenous people living there. 1649, the siege of Drogheda ends. Oliver Cromwell's parliamentarian troops take the town and execute its garrison. Cromwell didn't mess around. You oppose him, you die. 1683, Battle of Vienna. Coalition forces, including the famed Winged Hussars led by Polish King John III Sobieski, lift the siege laid by Ottoman forces. Now, for those that are not familiar with it, the Winged Hussars were one of the main types of Polish cavalry between the 16th and 18th centuries. Modeled on the Hungarian Hussars, the early Hussars were a light cavalry of exiled Balkan warriors who were sent to Poland as mercenaries. And following the military reforms of King Stephen Bathory in the second half of the 16th century, the Hussar unit was adopted by the Polish military and transformed into a heavily armored shock cavalry. They were kind of like our Marines. Okie dokie. 1697, Battle of Zenta. Major engagement in the Great Turkish War. And one of the most decisive defeats in Ottoman history. The Ottomans were no slouches when it came to military prowess, but when they got defeated, it was something to write home about. 1708, Charles XII of Sweden stops his march to conquer Moscow outside Smolensk, marking a turning point in the Great Northern War. And he's defeated 9 months later in the Battle of Poltava. The Swedish Empire ceases to be a major power at that point. 1709, Battle of Lipowicz. Great Britain, Netherlands, and Austria fight against France. 1714, Siege of Barcelona. Barcelona, the capital city of Catalonia, surrenders to Spanish and French Bourbon armies in the War of the Spanish Succession. 1758, Battle of St. Cast. French repels the British invasion during the Seven Years' War. 1775, Benedict Arnold's expedition to Quebec leaves Cambridge, Massachusetts. For those that are not familiar with Benedict Arnold, he was one of the most effective revolutionary commanders for U.S. forces until he decided to join the other side. 1776, British and American Peace Conference on Staten Island fails to stop the American Revolutionary War. 1777, Battle of Brandywine. The British celebrate a major victory in Chester County, Pennsylvania. 1780, Sugarloaf Massacre. A small detachment of militia from Northampton County are attacked by Native Americans and Loyalists near Little Nescopec Creek. It was a skirmish, actually. A number of Native Americans and a handful of Loyalists attacked a small detachment of militia. According to records and witness depositions, the militia detachment was led by Lieutenants John Moyer and John Fish of Captain Johannes Van Eaton's Company of Volunteers. Well, the men of the detachment had just sat down to eat dinner, according to survivor Peter Crum, when the Loyalists and Natives started firing muskets. 10 militiamen were killed, according to Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Bellet, who had gone with a small force of 150 to bury the dead. There were a lot of, shall we say, unfortunate occurrences in the war. All right, 1786, beginning of the Annapolis Convention. For those that are not familiar with what the Annapolis Convention is, formally titled as the Meeting of Commissioners to Remedy the Defects of the Federal Government. It was a national political convention held in 1786 at Mann's Tavern in Annapolis, Maryland. 12 delegates came from 5 states, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia. They wanted to discuss and develop a consensus on reversing the protectionist trade barriers that each state had erected. At this particular point in time, under the Articles of Confederation, each state was largely independent from the others. and the national government had no authority to regulate trade. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, North Carolina had appointed commissioners, but they failed to get to Annapolis in time to attend the meeting. Connecticut, Maryland, South Carolina, and Georgia just ignored the whole thing, which was typical. Alrighty. 1789, Alexander Hamilton is appointed the first U.S. Secretary of Treasury. 1792, the Hope Diamond is stolen along with other French crown jewels, and six men break into the house where they're stored. 1800, the Maltese National Congress battalions are disbanded by British Civil Commissioners Alexander Ball. 1802, the French annex the Kingdom of Piedmont. 1803, Battle of Delhi during the Second Anglo-Maratha War between British troops under General Lake and Marathas of Scinde's army under General Louis Burkean. 1813, this is during the War of 1812. British troops arrive in Mount Vernon, prepare to march to and invade Washington, D.C. 1814, climax of the Battle of Plattsburgh, a major U.S. victory in the war. 1826, Captain William Morgan, a Freemason, is arrested in Batavia, New York, for debt after declaring he'd published the Mysteries of Freemasonry. This sets in motion the events that lead to his mysterious disappearance. Nobody has any idea what ever happened to him. 1829, surrender the expedition led by Isidro Barradas at Tampico, sent by the Spanish crown to retake Mexico. This was the consummation of Mexico's campaign for independence. 1830, Anti-Masonic Party Convention, one of the first American political party conventions. 1836, the Rio Grandense Republic is proclaimed by rebels after defeating the Empire of Brazil's troops in the Battle of Cival during the Ragamuffin War. There's a lot of interesting wars. And the Ragamuffin War was a Republican uprising that began in southern Brazil in the province, which is currently a state, known as Rio Grande do Sul. The rebels, led by Generals Bento Goncalves de Silva and Antonio de Sousa Neto, with the support of the Italian fighter Giuseppe Garibaldi, surrendered to Imperial forces. It was the longest and third bloodiest of the failed wars of succession in the Brazilian Empire. After the Cabangajum Revolt and the Baladia Revolt. Interesting names they had for these things. The Ragamuffin War. Well, 1851, Christiana resistance. Escaped slaves led by William Parker fight off and kill a slave owner who, with a federal marshal and an armed party, sought to seize three of his former slaves in Christiana, Pennsylvania. This created a major standoff between slavery proponents and abolitionists. 1852, outbreak of the Revolution of September 11th. Resulting in the state of Buenos Aires declaring independence as a republic. 1857, the Mount Mutter Massacre. Mormon settlers and Paiutes massacre 120 pioneers at Mountain Meadows in Utah. 1897, after months of pursuit, the generals of Menelik II of Ethiopia capture Gaki Sarocho, the last king of Kaffa, which ended that ancient kingdom. 1903, the first race at the Milwaukee Mile in West Allis, Wisconsin is held. It's the oldest major speedway in the world. 1905, Ninth Avenue derailment occurs in New York City. 13 are killed. 1914, World War I, Australia invades German New Guinea, defeats a German contingent at the Battle of Betapaca. 1916, the Quebec Bridge's central span collapses, kills 11. The bridge previously collapsed completely on August 29, 1907, but it was rebuilt and everybody was assured everything was wonderful. 1919, U.S. Marine Corps invades Honduras. 1921, Nahalal, the first Moshev in Palestine, is settled as part of a Zionist plan to create a Jewish state Later, that Jewish state became Israel. 1922, the Treaty of Kars is ratified in Yerevan in Armenia. 1941, Charles Lindbergh's Des Moines speech accusing the British, the Jews, and FDR's administration of pressing for war with Germany. 1943, German troops occupy Corsica and Kosovo Motuhia, ending the Italian occupation of Corsica. 1944, the Western Allied invasion of Germany begins near the city of Aachen. Also in 1944, the RAF bombing raid on Darmstadt and the following firestorm killed 11,500 that are known. 1945, Australian 9th Division forces liberate the Japanese-run Batu Lintang Camp, POW and civilian internment camp on the island of Borneo. 1950, Korean War. Harry Truman approves military operations north of the 38th parallel. 1954, Hurricane Edna hits New England as a Category 2 hurricane, causes significant damage and 29 deaths. 1961, Hurricane Carlos strikes the Texas coast as a Category 4 hurricane, the second strongest storm ever to hit the state. 1965, Indo-Pakistani War. Indian Army captures the town of Berkey, just southeast of Lahore. 1967, China's People's Liberation Army launches an attack on Indian post at Nathdwara, Sikkim in India, which resulted in military clashes. 1968, Air France Flight 1611 crashes off Nice, France, kills 89 passengers and 6 crew. Never did determine the reason for that crash. 1970, Dawson Field hijackers release 88 of their hostages. The remaining hostages, mostly Israeli citizens, are held until September 25th. 1971, the Egyptian Constitution becomes official. 1972, San Francisco Bay Area Rapid Transit System begins passenger service. 1973, a coup in Chile headed by General Augusto Pinochet topples the democratically elected President Allende. Pinochet exercises dictatorial powers until ousted in a referendum in 1988, but he stayed in power until 1990. 1973, Jet Airways Flight 769 crashes into the Langanik mountain range while on approach to Titograd Airport. 35 passengers and 6 crew die. 1974, Eastern Airlines Flight 2012 crashes in Charlotte, North Carolina. 69 passengers and 2 crew die. 1976, a bomb planted by a Croatian terrorist, Zvonko Busic, is found at New York's Grand Central Terminal. One NYPD officer is killed trying to defuse the bomb. 1980, a new constitution of Chile is established under the influence of then-Chilean dictator Pinochet, which is subject to controversy in Chile today. 1982, the international forces that are guaranteeing the safety of Palestinian refugees following Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon leave Beirut. 5 days later, several thousand refugees are massacred in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps by Falange forces. 1989, Hungary announces the East German refugees who've been housed in temporary camps are free to leave for West Germany. 1991, Continental Express Flight 2574 crashes in Colorado County, Texas. That's near Eagle Lake. 11 passengers and 3 crew die. 1992, Hurricane Iniki, one of the most damaging hurricanes in U.S. history, devastates Hawaiian Islands of Kauai and Oahu. 1997, NASA's Mars Global Surveyor reaches Mars. Also in 97. After a nationwide referendum, Scotland votes to establish the devolved parliament within the UK. 2001, a series of coordinated terrorist attacks killed 2,977 people with using 4 aircraft hijacked by 19 members of Al-Qaeda. Now, there's a lot of controversy still about who actually was on board those planes. 2 aircraft crash into the World Trade Center in New York City, on national TV, I might add. 3rd crashes into the Pentagon in Arlington County, Virginia, and the 4th in a field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. A lot of questions still about what went on. 2007, Russia tests the largest conventional weapon ever, the father of all bombs. 2008, a major channel tunnel fire breaks out on a freight train. Part of the tunnel had to be closed for 6 months. 2011, the National September 11th Memorial and Museum opens on the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. 2012, 315 people killed in two garment factory fires in Pakistan. 2012, the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya is attacked, resulting in 4 deaths. But as Hillary said, she was okay, so what did it matter? 2015, a crane collapses into the Masjid al-Haram Mosque in Saudi Arabia. 111 are killed and almost 400 are injured. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Let's see what we got in the way of holidays. The Battle of Tundra Day in Russia. Christian feast days. Blessed Francisco Bonifacio. Daniel. Felix Regulan Experientius. Harry Burley in the Episcopal Church. John Gabriel Perboy and one of the martyr saints in China. Leusinus and Bobo. Our Lady of Coromoto. Paphnutius of Thebes in the Roman Catholic Church. Patiens of Lyon, Proteus and Hyacinthia. Spiroandia, Theodora of Alexandria. Death anniversary of Qaid al-Zam Muhammad al-Jinir in Pakistan. Emergency number day in the U.S. Inkutatash falls on this day, if it's not a leap year. In Ethiopia and Rastafari. National Day in Catalonia. Nowruz in the Coptic Church. Coptic Orthodox Church, I might add. September 11 attacks, related observances in the U.S. It's National Day of Service and Remembrance and Patriots Day. And in Argentina, it is Teachers Day. Now, we were talking at some length about September 11th. The Now, it happened on the morning of Tuesday, September 11th, 2001. I was in my office, and we actually had the TV running. Now, there were over 25,000 injuries, and a lot of folks with substantial long-term health consequences, and there were at least 2,977 deaths. $10 billion in damage to the infrastructure and property damage. It's the single deadliest terrorist attack in human history, and the single deadliest incident for firefighters and law enforcement in the history of the U.S. 343 firefighters and 72 law enforcement were killed. Now, these 4 passenger airliners departed from airports in the northeastern United States. They were heading for California. And according to the scenario, they were hijacked by 19 Al-Qaeda terrorists. 2 of the planes, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175, crashed into the North and South Towers of the World Trade Center. Both 110-story towers collapsed within an hour and 42 minutes. There's another building that collapsed on its own, and that had the Emergency Operations Center for New York City in it. A third plane, Flight 77, an American Airlines flight, crashed into the Pentagon and led to the partial collapse of the building's west side. The fourth plane, United Airlines Flight 93, was initially flown toward Washington. It was going to either be slammed into the Capitol building or the White House. But it crashed in a field in Stony Brook Township after the passengers attacked the hijackers. Now, suspicion quickly fell on Al-Qaeda, and that resulted in the launching of the war on terror and invading Afghanistan. Because the Taliban, which controlled Afghanistan, had been There had been a demand made for them to expel Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan and to extradite Osama bin Laden. The Taliban refused to do it, and that led to the invasion. Now, bin Laden initially denied any involvement, but in 2004, he did claim responsibility. I've had some FBI agents tell me that based on the evidence, had bin Laden gone to trial, there wouldn't have been enough to convict him. As I say, there's still a lot of questions. We may have more information about that before the show's over. But for right now, I'm going to go back to talking about strange encounters. You know, as I've said many times before, time is not a solidly linear process. It can, in fact, become almost circular in nature. Now, in this particular instance, Jim Bradley and his wife weren't enjoying their holiday. They'd been looking forward so much to their first trip to France after the war, but the summer of 1954 was wet, cold, and windy. And the day they'd picked a visit to the Palace of Versailles started off as one long, nonstop thunderstorm. Now, they'd traveled all the way from Yorkshire. They were determined they were going to see the splendor of that palace and the grounds no matter what the weather was like. But strolling through the wrecked grounds around Versailles, they reached the Trianon's spot from where there was a path leading to the village of Hamel. Supposed to have been a favorite walk of Marie Antoinette's. But as I say, the weather was very foul. So the Bradleys hadn't seen anybody else during their excursions, and they were getting ready to go back to their car when the weather changed. The sun came through the clouds, the rain stopped. But instead of cheering them up, they felt a strange drop in the temperature. Everything around them became still, so cold. And afterwards, they recalled how no birds had started singing at the arrival of the sun. Leaving the Grand Trianon buildings behind them, they walked across the parklands. And as they did so, they started on a journey that actually took them into the past. As the mist that had been shrouding everything lifted, they realized they had not been alone in the grounds, even though they thought they were. Because coming toward them were three other people, two men and a woman. It wasn't until the group got nearer that Ms. Bradley gasped with surprise and pointed out to her husband the unusual clothing the other woman was wearing. Her dress was a vivid, striking orange color with a close-fitting bodice, a full skirt reaching down to her ankles, and there was attractive, frilled-out material at the waist. Now, the Bradleys are quite close to the other group. Miss Bradley was so intrigued with the other woman's gown, she didn't bother to notice what the two men were wearing. Even, well, she could remember later, they were dressed in dark. But Jim Bradley noticed the men's costumes are unusual as well. From no more than 40 yards away, he observed the men were wearing long coats that reached almost to their knees, black breeches, stockings, and shoes with silver buckles. And the three were chatting gaily among themselves as they walked along. Now, not wishing to intrude, the Bradleys tried not to stare too obviously at the other three people. And as they got closer, they tried to pay attention to their surroundings. And suddenly, to their shock, the three people walking toward them vanished. They could not have passed out of sight behind any trees because there were none near the route. Nor could they have left the path because there was a high wall and a ditch running alongside it. Neither of the Bradleys could figure out where they went. Mr. Bradley agreed that the sudden disappearance of the three was strange and startling. And something even stranger happened. Suddenly and dramatically, the Bradleys felt a strange sensation as if walking through a silent tunnel. One moment they had been in sunlight, where the only sound had been their footsteps and voices, and next they were back in the noise of the rainstorm. Now, neither of the Bradleys had ever had any interest in the supernatural before this experience, and neither one of them had experienced anything similar since then. Now, a number of strange things followed their experience. Later that morning, when questioning an attendant at Versailles, they asked him about the oddly dressed trio they'd seen during a break in the thunderstorm. The attendant's reply startled them. He was adamant there had not been a break in the storm. The rain and the thunder had lasted all morning, and nobody else but the Bradleys had been seen wandering about Versailles that day. But there had been stories about supernatural appearances near that spot. As I said, it had been a favorite part of the garden for Marie Antoinette. And when the attendant told him about that, he also led him to a portrait of the queen herself. The background in the portrait was the same as where the Bradleys had seen the woman, in orange. And to their shock, the woman they had seen was the subject of the portrait. They had seen Marie Antoinette. Now, what would have been interesting is if they had made an effort to make her aware of her fate, perhaps rescued her. Could she have left her time and come to ours? Or theirs? We'll never know. You know, some ghosts, often the more active, are believed to be earthbound, haunting their old surroundings because of some terrible tragedy, because of some great sorrow they can't forget even when they get to the other side. Colin Matterly was a young man who inherited a house in the Hampshire village of Overton, and he came up against such a ghost. Now, as he was living in quite comfortable rooms at that time, he decided to rent the house out to tenants, bringing a second income that he could certainly use. Eventually, when he had accumulated enough money, he'd get married and move into the house with his wife. First tenants occupied this comfortable country house in January 1957. But before that month was halfway through, they left. And what was more, they were angry at Colin for letting them live there. When he asked why they had decided to leave so quickly, the woman looked at him, shook her fist, and said, "You might have warned us we were sharing that place with a ghost." Well, Colin found that highly amusing because he didn't believe in ghosts. But once the tenants left, the house remained unoccupied. Nobody else wanted to live there. And worse than this, Colin's fiancée refused to live in a haunted house after they were married. Well, Colin set out to prove to everybody the house was not haunted. He went there to live himself. And despite the strange happenings that commenced the moment he walked in the house, he insisted there were rational explanations to all of them. Doors began to open and shut of their own volition, so he took off all the doors and rehung them. But they still kept opening and closing on their own. Then when one door, which he'd very carefully locked, opened up again, he began to wonder. Objects were lifted and lowered again right in front of his eyes when he was quite alone in the house, but he couldn't see anything that would cause this. One evening he closed the book he'd been reading and sat it down on the table, and seconds later saw the book open and the page start to turn. It was somebody's looking through the book. Later on he heard drawers opening and closing of their own accord in all the rooms. Eventually he grew to expect to find things misplaced or overturned, pictures taken down from the walls, the sound of footsteps in the house when he was entirely alone. Well, in the summer of that year, he decided it was time to clean out the old attic upstairs. He knew there had to be a lot of old junk up there. Well, in the attic, he found a large quantity of clothes, which had evidently once belonged to the man who'd left the house to him. But there were also some women's clothes. He knew the former owner, a lawyer, had had a beautiful daughter who had tragically died. And he also knew the girl had been in love with a young man who had loved her, but the boy's father had been against the match. As he sorted out the clothes and packed them into cases and boxes intending to dispose of them, he came across a small diary and a letter in the pocket of a pale blue summer coat. Well, he read those, and he knew they were written in the hand of the girl who had died of what was said to be a broken heart. The note read, "Nobody's told me as much, my dearest love, but I can sense that I'm very, very sick. We may not meet again in this world. If this should be, I implore you to make every promise that when you die, we may lie side by side in our graves." Eventually, Colin managed to track the family down of the young man who had been the girl's lover. And earnestly, Colin told him about the tragedy of the unhappy spirit that was haunting his own house, and a solution was found. Arrangements were made for the two bodies to be reburied in the cemetery side by side. And from that moment on, there were no more ghosts about Colin Matterly's house. Or if they were, they were probably so happy they kept to themselves. And what became of Colin's fiancée isn't known. Maybe she married him, maybe she didn't. But those that were causing the greatest upset apparently were happy. Well, there have been many stories about long-lived people, Barnabas Collins and Dark Shadows. But the man who probably had the reputation of being the oldest was the Comte de Saint-Germain. Late one night, just before Christmas in 1780, the Comte de Saint-Germain strode slowly across the snow-covered courtyard of the royal palace in Saxe-Holstein, footsteps clearly marked behind him in the snow. And the two sentries pacing to and fro by the main gateway saluted as he passed, but he ignored them. Neither of the soldiers had ever seen him look so tired before. Just outside the gate, he paused and stifled a yawn, shook his head, studying the vast stretch of unmarked, freshly fallen snow that lay in front of him as far as the eye could see. As the sentries paced about behind him, stamping their feet fiercely on the ground to keep the circulation going, they expressed their surprise. The Comte ignored the cold. For almost an hour, the man stood there, motionless. And each time the sentries passed the gate, they looked at him in surprise. What could he possibly be thinking about? He had to be mad standing out there in the cold. And then suddenly, he was gone. The Comte de Saint-Germain vanished. The surprised sentries ran forward through the gate to see what had happened, but there was no sign of anything either to arouse their suspicion or to reassure them that nothing was wrong. But frankly, something was wrong. The Comte wouldn't have re-entered the castle without passing them, and apart from that, his only footsteps were those leading from the castle to the spot where he'd been standing when he vanished. Beyond the clearly marked spot on which he stood for so long, and all around lay the unmarked virgin snow, with not one other footprint in sight. The Comte de Saint-Germain had vanished as mysteriously and as abruptly as he'd been plucked from the ground by some giant hand from the sky. And yet this mystery was just one of many that had surrounded the Comte for more than 40 years. Because it seemed that he was the man who discovered the secret of eternal youth. You see, in all that time, he had never looked one minute older than when he first appeared at the French court in Versailles in 1740. Now, there were a number of other mysteries about him, but the most baffling one was, who was he? Where'd he come from? And more baffling than anything else, where'd he go when he disappeared that evening in Schleswig-Holstein? During the 18th century, the Comte was the mystery man of Europe. He spoke 8 different languages with faultless fluency without any accent. He was a talented musician, a brilliant historian, an alchemist, and the most notorious seducer on the entire continent. When he first arrived in France, just before 1740, he startled the world by declaring he was more than 2,000 years old. Because his claims were that he had discovered certain drugs that preserved his youth forever. Certainly when he first arrived in Paris, a tall, handsome, talented young man in his late 20s, few people believed him. But as the years slipped past and he showed no signs of aging, folks began to wonder. Maybe he was telling the truth after all. And on the night he disappeared, many credible eyewitness accounts, which are still in existence, gave testimony to the fact he never looked even 1 hour older than he did when he first appeared.
Another factor that appeared to support his claim of great age was his detailed knowledge of languages and history, as well as the confident way in which he could discuss these subjects with the experts of long standing. Even in such rare subjects as Oriental languages, customs, and history, his knowledge was quite unique. Maybe it wasn't surprising if, as he claimed, he'd lived as a soldier of fortune in China centuries before Marco Polo went that way in the 12th century. And his career as a soldier continued when he came to France. Louis XV was so susceptible to the man's charm, he named him Comte de Saint-Germain and employed him as a secret agent on many occasions. One reason for this was that the Comte claimed he couldn't be killed. And certainly he had an astounding power to recover from seemingly fatal wounds. It was confirmed several times that furious husbands fought him in duels after the Comte had seduced their wives. On at least 6 occasions, the Comte de Saint-Germain lost a duel, was declared dead. But a few days later, he would reappear as active and as handsome and as bold as ever. Even stranger was the mysterious way in which his body healed after being wounded. For many, many people, especially as many mistresses, swore on oath that there was not a single scar on his body. When he fell out of favor at the French court, he moved to England, where he spoke the language with a fluency and ease that surprised everybody. His knowledge of English court affairs and customs for the past 300 years, even in matters that were known only to a few people, was uncanny. And he traveled to Russia at the invitation of the Tsarina, Catherine the Great. He went on to become one of her lovers and played an active part in court intrigue. After another few years in France, 10 years after fleeing Louis XV's wrath, he returned to ingratiate himself with the aging monarch, who was astounded by Comte de Saint-Germain's appearance, because everybody in France noticed the Comte looked exactly as he had when he first arrived at the French court in 1740. Well, Louis XV died in May of 1774 when the Comte was in Germany on a mission for him. When he heard the news, he decided to stay exactly where he was. And as usual, his way of life made many enemies in Germany, but in spite of many plots to murder him, he always had the uncanny knack of being aware of these plots. And if a murder attempt seemed to succeed, even by poison, the Comte would reappear a few days later as cool and confident as if nothing had happened to him. Finally, he took up residence with Prince Charles in the castle at Schleswig-Holstein, where he promised to reveal his alchemistry secrets to the prince. They began spending their time in debauchery or studying sorcery and raising the devil and a number of other related events. Soon he acquired the reputation of being Satan himself, and it did appear to be a well-deserved reputation. The palace servants and the local peasants certainly feared him. If he rode past them, they would avoid his shadow and cross themselves. After his arrival in Schleswig-Holstein, there was an outbreak of strange murders that were attributed to a werewolf. And each time one of these horrible crimes was committed, always the victim was a young girl or a child, the Comte de Saint-Germain was always off somewhere by himself. And suddenly, on that cold December night, he vanished. No footprints to indicate where he'd gone. And in his abrupt departure into thin air, he'd left all his personal possessions, including a fortune and jewels, behind in the castle. Well, the two sentries had remarked how tired he'd looked when they last saw him. Maybe he had been, because the Comte always said that when he was tired of this present life, I'll go away again and sleep for a few centuries before I come back. Did he come back? Will he come back? Well, let's talk about the secret of the hidden attic. Albert Fennell sensed almost immediately there was something odd in the atmosphere of the small inn at Southwell, Nottinghamshire. He went there to visit his father in 1928. See, the landlord was his cousin Frank Morley, who had only recently taken the place over and was planning on making into a thriving hostelry with his wife Betty making meals. Curiously enough, it was only on the day that Albert and his father arrived that the Morleys heard the inn was supposed to be haunted. Well, the very idea amused them and their visiting cousins, and somehow the idea pleased them, as Albert's father said jokingly, at least it should be good for business, a haunted pub. Later that night, when Albert was sitting by himself in a downstairs living room, he's reading a book. It was a fairly mild night. There was a fire glowing in the hearth in front of him, and it was probably the heat from the fire that made Albert nod off to sleep. But then a sudden drop in temperature brought him fully awake again. Woke up shivering. Deciding he was probably tired after the long journey earlier that day, and it was just coming up to midnight, he went upstairs to his bedroom. On his way there, he passed a grandfather clock just as it started to chime midnight. At least it should have chimed 12. But climbing the stairs, Albert mentally counted the chimes, and at 11 the clock suddenly gave a groan and stopped. He put on the light in his room, undressed, and as he was climbing into bed, he heard footsteps approaching his bedroom door. He stood and turned and was shocked when he saw the knob of his door start to turn. The door slowly opened. He saw a shadowy, vague figure come into the room. He was prompted by fear or annoyance he couldn't say, but he picked up a heavy book that lay on a small table at the bedside and threw it at the shadowy figure. And to his horror, the book went right through the figure, crashed into the wall behind it, and thudded to the floor. The specter vanished, and Albert jumped into bed. The next morning, he was horrified to see the book had cracked the wall plaster and a large piece had fallen out on the bedroom floor. Albert apologized to his cousin for damaging the wall and promised he'd do the repair himself, but as he was about to repair that broken plaster, he saw part of a door panel behind the crack. So quickly, he removed the plaster and uncovered the door that seemed to be locked. Well, his cousin, who was the landlord, as I mentioned, brought in a carpenter to force the door open. Behind it was a narrow flight of stairs that led up to another door leading into a small attic. Now thoroughly intrigued, Frank Morley tried to find out something about the history of the place, and with Albert, who now felt he had a proprietary interest in the ghost, he learned that shortly after the place had been built in 1864, it had been occupied by an eccentric old man and his servant. Now, certainly, it had been an odd pair, and no one in the district was very surprised when the owner was arrested one day for murdering the servant up in the attic. Several years later, another tenant had decided to seal off the attic after being troubled by strange bangings on the door and hearing ghostly footsteps on the stairs that were behind it. Whether the ghost was that of the murdered servant seeking revenge on his master, or the master seeking to apologize to the servant, nobody really knew. But ever since the attic door was reopened, there had been no further trouble at the inn. So apparently, ghosts can be appeased. Well, if you've ever been by an old antique shop, you see things there that are absolutely mind-boggling in their strangeness. That was also a habit that Richard Crocker cultivated. He spent part of his lunch breaks browsing the antique shops and auction rooms in London's West End. And that's what he was doing on the afternoon of in March 1958. That was when he first saw the Eustabi dolls. He'd been wandering around the large antique shop, studying the items that attracted his attention when he saw the carefully colorfully painted box. Picking it up, he raised a lid and peered inside at the row of five exquisitely carved little dolls. He found them absolutely fascinating to contemplate, and he made a few inquiries of the proprietor. Shopkeeper explained they were Egyptian figures known as Eustabi dolls and been used in traditional funeral ceremonies thousands of years ago. Now, Crocker had been quite intrigued with the dolls and studied them at great length, but he had no intention of buying them, so he carefully put them back in the box and left the shop. When he got home that evening, he found his young daughter had become ill. Unexpectedly experienced a sensation of apprehension that somehow the Eustabi dolls were to blame for the illness, but he shrugged off his hunch as nothing more than nonsense. When his wife told him when their dolls, it must have been just about the exact time he picked up the Eustabi dolls. Later, when his daughter was taken to Hampstead Hospital, the doctors said they couldn't find anything at all wrong with her. But there was no question she was ill. Well, this information gave Richard even more food for thought, but he still couldn't understand why his mind should suddenly be preoccupied with thoughts about the Ustabi dolls. Or why he didn't even think there was a connection between himself touching the dolls and his daughter's becoming mysteriously ill. Well, a short time later, his daughter recovered and seemed none the worse to wear for the strange illness. But then something that finally convinced Richard Crocker there had to be some sort of curse on the Ustabi dolls took place. A year later, Richard was gazing into the window of another antique shop and he saw a Ustabi doll. Instantly, he had the most awful conviction he had to get back home as quickly as possible. He hurried home where he found his daughter had collapsed again exactly as she'd done the year before. And again, it had happened at the exact moment he had seen that Ustabi doll. After that, Crocker was hoping that he'll never see another one of the dolls. And he's wondered what disaster would have happened if he bought one. You know, I've said many times that ghosts can attach themselves to, or spirits in general can attach themselves to items. And if you buy the item, you get the spirit as well. Well, sometimes spirits are just mischievous. Eric Essex and his wife were watching TV late one evening in July of 1965 when the living room doorway started to creak open slowly behind them. Well, first they thought it had been wind that caused the door to open, but his wife pointed out the door handle is being turned from the other side of the door. Jumping to his feet, Eric crossed the room and pulled the door open, and there was nobody there. And just as he was about to investigate the hallway, he stopped and stared because the door handle was ever so slowly lowering itself back into place. And he was the only one close to the door. Well, this was the first of a series of weird incidents that were to harass the Essex family in their new home in Northfleet in Kent. First, they were inclined to explain the whole business away as some sort of elaborate practical joke, though they didn't know who might be playing it on them. Then it reached such a pitch it began to affect Marie's nerves. Soon, she couldn't bear to be alone in the house, even during the day. And Eric decided the happenings were really unnatural. For a while, it was only a case of doors mysteriously and noisily creaking open. But strangely, when there were these very doors open in a normal way, either quickly or slowly, they made no noise at all. Then one evening, when they returned home from a show with some friends, another strange event took place. As soon as they entered the darkness of their house, the kitchen light suddenly came on. As both the Essex and their friends were standing several yards away from the kitchen, beside the front door, none of them could have done that themselves. Immediately suspecting there were prowlers in the house, Eric and the two other men rushed into the kitchen to find it absolutely empty. Nobody there but them. Then started a game of hide-and-seek as the Essex and their friends ran all over the house with doors mysteriously opening and closing and lights being switched on and off. But the end result of their search is where there was no one in the house but them. This state of affairs began to happen every few days. You know, one or two occasions, noises were heard just like somebody trying to stifle a chuckle. And one night, Eric and Marie Essex were suddenly awakened by the sound of somebody moving about the house. Eric jumped out of bed and searched every room but found nobody. For the next 18 months, these unexplained happenings went on. And then finally, they saw the ghost. Mr. Essex was asleep, but he was suddenly awakened from a deep sleep by a whistling sound. And he saw standing close to where he lay a little girl. Then the whole bed started to shake and the ghost vanished. Well, shortly after that, the couple moved out. Some months later, when they heard about the tenants and moved into the house after him, they also moved out in a hurry when they saw the child's ghost. Now, nobody's been able to find out why she haunts that house, who she was, or what might have happened to them, but You know, frankly, everybody seems to be in agreement. She seems to be a happy enough little ghost. Certainly mischievous, like a child. Well, you know, I've written a lot and talked a lot about UFOs and mysterious abductions. Well, 1955, it was August. August 21st, to be exact. A few minutes before midnight, a car roared into Hopkinsville, Kentucky. It raced down the main street to the jailhouse, where it screeched to a halt. The driver staggered into the building and told the most fantastic story Police Chief Greenwell had ever heard. The man wanted him to round up a posse to help fight off an army of little green men who were besieging his home. The man was a farmer by the name of Cecil Sutton, and he told the police chief we've been fighting them off for hours. And the investigation that followed this report sparked off an incredible story. Driving out to the isolated farmhouse at Kelly, about 9 miles out of Hopkinsville, with a band of armed deputies, Greenwell listened to the weird story all over again. Now, he knew Sutton well, and he saw no reason to agree with his deputies who were inclined to think that Sutton had been drinking. Greenwell knew very well that Cecil Sutton never touched anything stronger than coffee in his entire life, and he was, to put it very kindly, not an imaginative man. It was Greenwell's opinion that something had frightened the man very badly. According to Sutton, early that night, he and his wife were entertaining some friends at the farm, and a flying saucer landed in the field a few yards away. And then a group of about 12 small green men left the airship through a hatch and came to the farmhouse. Now, he said they were no more than 4 feet high. Their eyes were like saucers and glowed with a luminous pinkish light in the sunlight, in the moonlight, rather. Their hands were long with needle-like nails, and they had pointed cat-like ears. It was Cecil Sutton's friend Billy Taylor had seen them first, and when the aliens realized they had been spotted, they came to the house more quickly. Well, both men snatched up guns, told their wives to lock the door and hide the children in the storm cellar, and smashed a window and started firing at the strange creatures. Well, Sutton's first shot hit one of the little green men, sent him tumbling back down the porch steps. Thinking they'd killed him, Sutton and Taylor crept out of the house to investigate. But then one of the aliens who had climbed onto the roof grabbed Taylor by the hair and started to pull him onto the roof. Sutton spun around, shot the creature in the chest, but the bullet only ricocheted away. After this, the two men went back in the house, and all their bullets seemed to be able to do was keep the attackers at bay. It'd knock them down, but they'd jump right back to their feet again. Well, the battle raged for over 3 hours, with the attackers sending beams of light sizzling through the night at the house. Fortunately, these light rays seemed to have no effect other than dazzling Sutton and Taylor for a few minutes. Gradually, the green men retreated from the farmyard, and Sutton made a break toward his car. And as he raced off through the night for help, one of the aliens rushed in front of his car. Sutton hit him, and he went spinning across the road into the ditch, but as Sutton drove to Hopkinsville, the faint sounds of gunfire were all that could be heard. Sutton says there were no signs of the battle. To all intents and purposes, the guns might have been firing nothing. And that was Police Chief Greenwell's first thought, too, as he drove into the farmyard with his posse, because all he saw was the shuttered farmhouse. No spaceship, no strange beings from outer space to be seen. Maybe Sutton had been drinking. Then he saw the other occupants at the house. The women were almost hysterical with fear. Taylor still clutched his gun and looked nervously into the darkness, while down in the storm cellar, Greenwell and his deputies could hear the children crying. Well, there wasn't much he could do that evening but leave two deputies to patrol the area. In the morning, the police came back, searched the farm and the area around it. Neither the Taylors, the Suttons, or the deputies who had remained on duty had seen or heard anything during the night. One deputy reported he had heard nothing at all, and that was what made him nervous. He hadn't seen any animals moving, not even heard an owl hooting all night long. Just a long, eerie stillness. Well, of course, the whole business might have been some wild hoax, as a lot of folks thought. And even Greenwell might have accepted this for an explanation if it wasn't for what happened next. 48 hours later, on August 23rd, 1955, the Sutton farmhouse was found completely deserted. The Suttons had disappeared with only their personal possessions, and they left several valuable pieces of farm equipment sitting behind them. Now, maybe they'd fled because they were scared, or maybe they were abducted. Nobody knows, because nobody's seen or heard from the family since. Well, we've come to the end of another show and another week. We'll be back on Monday when, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall on the Ken Hudnall Show. Till then, have a great weekend.